to the third case of the day, appeal number 09-2281, Don Kettleson versus Astru. Mr. Balanoff.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm James Balanoff of counsel with the firm of Daly, Dabowski & Bryant for the appellant, Don Kettleson. This is an appeal of a denial of Social Security disability benefits to plaintiff Don Kettleson. At the she was, at the time of her date last insured for Social Security benefits, she was 52 years of age. Having been born in 1955, she worked for many years, almost 25 years, at an a heavy job as a setup technician in a plastics molding plant. She ultimately had to cease working there. She was physically unable to continue. She has multiple physical impairments as well as a mental impairment. Fibromyalgia, problems with her lumbar disc, and a significant history of depression. The ALJ's decision, which of course is reviewed de novo, is deficient in many respects. First of all, he failed to assess the credibility of the claimant's testimony in a sufficient fashion, found it not credible, but did not adhere to the guidelines that are required under Social Security ruling 96-7P for the assessment of credibility. And in fact, there simply is not substantial evidence to support his determination. He claimed that essentially she was engaged in a lot of activities because she had been to two dog shows in 2007, zero in 2006, but he emphasized this very much. The fact of the matter, her activities are really severely circumscribed. In terms of her depression, which she found to be a not severe impairment, the only mental health provider or professional, I should say, to make an opinion was Dr. Desmond, who she was referred to twice by Social Security. Both times he indicated that she suffered from depression, rated her GAF at 55 to 65, which implies at least mild, if not moderate, impairments in ability to work. Certainly that satisfies the criteria for what is a severe impairment. That is one that imposes more than minor limitations on the ability to work. It simply is ridiculous to say that she did not have a severe mental impairment. In terms of her physical RFC, he left out, significant limitations found by a doctor she was referred to for Social Security, including inability or limitations on the ability to bend. When he submitted this, his RFC, to the vocational expert who testified at the second hearing, he did not include that, and did not include the psychological limitations. Therefore, the very few jobs that the vocational expert found that she could do are really irrelevant, because the hypothetical did not include all of her limitations.
The dog-related activities,
yes.
While attending just a few shows in 07, in order to keep the dogs up, that's fairly daily.
Well, certainly.
Required activity, isn't it? And these are Lhasa Apses, aren't they?
Yes, I'm not really familiar with the breed, but I think a dog is a dog, and maybe not. I don't know. In any event, I think there's case law. It's really clear that doing daily activities, she wasn't running a business raising dogs, so forth and so on. She had a few dogs she took care of, And at the end, it was only a few.
She was selling some of the dog.
She had, but that activity had diminished.
She had kind of a bird.
She had birds as well.
And was selling some of the birds.
Yes, but the amount of money that she realized from that clearly was not substantial gainful activity.
True,
and
but there are activities associated
no
with
doubt.
Doing those things.
Certainly.
Maybe somewhat sedentary, but it does require some physical involvement.
It does, but it doesn't require that involvement for 8 hours a day. And that's the point, I think, particularly when you consider the nature of her physical impairment, especially the fibromyalgia. You can do things for a while, but fatigue sets in. Also, the depression. One can do certain things, but not all day long. And I think that's really the point is that, sure, she can engage in certain daily activities, and I think there's adequate case law that alone doesn't mean someone can work all day. And that, I think, is what's involved here. If she could have, there's no reason, I think, that she wouldn't have continued working, or that she would not have not working at a job. Why would she then not have carried on the dog business, raising dogs and birds? Why did it diminish over time? It diminished over time as her condition deteriorated. And I think there's ample medical evidence that this her condition was not the same. It continued to deteriorate over time. So
Mr. Malinoff,
I think
these are tough cases for ALJs, obviously, where you're
certainly
dealing with a lot of subjective evidence. Did any doctors in this case express the opinion, based on the condition they were studying, that she could not work? I'm not talking about Dr. Desmond's comments about pain, but since that wasn't really what he was doing. But did any doctors say she really just can't do this?
I don't think so, but I think there certainly is ample evidence. They found medical findings which would indicate that. I think in terms of her primary care was provided by a physician's assistant and by Dr. White, I believe who the PA Mr. Kruger worked under. The symptomology that they found was not consistent with an ability to work in terms of the severity of the depression, in terms of the pain of the fibromyalgia. I think in terms of opinions, there simply aren't really any opinions by any doctor who examined or treated her that are clear-cut opinions. Dr. Stutt, I believe that's how it's pronounced, who she saw at the behest of the state agency in Wisconsin, did find limitations. He found that perhaps she could do light work, but there were limitations on things like bending and so forth, and those were precisely the things, as our brief indicates, that were not included in the RFC. The jobs that were found, what the ALJ found was that in his RFC was that she could do light work if she had a sit-stand option where she could rest for 5 minutes, stand for 45, rest for 5 minutes, and bend and stoop. As to the bending, he left out the limitations on the bending. The job of the optical salvager and so forth obviously requires bending, particularly if you're standing or sitting.
If she could do the light work with those restrictions, yes, she could also do sedentary work in that same opinion.
Not necessarily.
Why
not necessarily, because sometimes sitting is more difficult for someone with lower back problems than standing.
But we're talking about a sit-stand option.
Yes, but the sit-stand option was not a real sit-stand option. It was simply that she could rest for 5 minutes, stand and then rest for 5 minutes. And so that in that respect, it was not. Finally, I want to reserve my time, but finally, her obesity, he did not take into account. He certainly should have. That is something, there's ample case law, as we point out. The obesity in combination with everything else has to be taken into account, and the ALJ did not do that. And in her case, the obesity was significant. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Siegel. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case. Your Honors, we're presented with a case that involves the question of whether substantial evidence supports the ALJ's finding that Ms. Kittleson is not disabled. In making this finding, the ALJ considered Ms. Kittleson's credibility. He assessed her residual functional capacity for both physical and mental impairments, and he also obtained vocational expert testimony regarding the number of jobs that would be available considering the functional capacity limitations that he assessed. Of particular importance of this case is the claimant's credibility, and the ALJ did a very thorough analysis of this of the claimant's credibility, and it can be found throughout his decision, pages 21 through 26 in particular. He talks specifically about the claimant's symptoms, and he talks about whether they are supported by the record as a whole and identifies objective medical findings, treatment history, physician assessments, and the claimant's own statements and testimony about what she was able to do as informing his decision about whether he found she was credible or not. With regard to her depressive symptoms, the ALJ noted that the claimant had a very brief history of treatment for depression, that Dr. White had prescribed some medication for her, and it was monitored by Mr. Kruger, who was a physician assistant. But other than that, she did not receive any kind of inpatient or outpatient counseling or hospitalizations or in a psychiatric hospital to treat her mental condition. Ms. Kittleson has not shown any basis that her treatment was a basis for showing that she was should be credible.
I thought the district court found, though, that the ALJ had erred in that respect, in failing to look into or consider reasons why she might not have pursued additional treatment
because
she didn't, because of insurance.
And well,
we know the district court found it harmless, but she did say it was an error, right?
Well, the district court said it was a harmless error about the lack of insurance. Now, Ms. Kittleson bases her contention that she was not able to get treatment for her psychiatric condition because of her lack of insurance on a statement that she made to Dr. Desmond, who was a consulting examiner. And she told Dr. Desmond that she had Badger Care, which is a type of state health insurance in Wisconsin, and that she didn't feel that many doctors I only have Badger Care these days, and there's not too many places that will take that. That's what she said. And that was merely conjecture on her part. There is nothing in the record that shows that she ever followed up with any kind of treatment for psychological counseling. Also, there's no indication that Dr. White, who was her family physician, who was giving her antidepressant medication, had suggested that she should go to counseling or that she should be hospitalized or should get any kind of inpatient or outpatient psychological treatment. So she didn't get a referral from Dr. White. And Dr. Badeau, he was an examining neurologist who suggested that she should possibly get a she was undertreated for her mood disorder, and he gave her a referral for a psychiatrist. But again, there's no record that she actually followed up with that referral or that that the referral was rejected because of a lack of insurance. So the ALJ reasonably thought that her lack of treatment was a factor that he could consider in determining whether she was credible or not.
But what about the obesity argument? Where does the ALJ treat that?
He does mention obesity in his list of impairments, and he does talk about doctors who mentioned her obesity, talked about her weight, and who assessed her functioning. And he adopted the restrictions that were set forth by the doctors. We have a number of doctors who have assessed her functioning. Like I said, she didn't get a lot of treatment, but she did have a lot of consultative examinations. And many of the consultative examiners assessed her functioning, and they all noted her obesity. For example, Dr. Fu found that she was able to do light work with intermittent rest periods. Dr. Stutt also found limitations that were consistent with light work. He said 20 pounds lifting and 45 minutes of standing, so that the ALJ adopted those restrictions when he made the residual functional capacity, and the fact that those doctors considered her obesity, and that the ALJ actually did talk about the obesity in the decision. He just, there wasn't a specific paragraph that summed everything up, but throughout the decision, he definitely recognizes her obesity.
So your position is that these bending, lifting, other limitations are related to her obesity?
Pardon me?
The limitations on bending, stooping. So
actually, Dr. Stutt never found a limitation on bending and stooping. He noted that she had difficulty bending and squatting in his objective findings, but then when he assessed her limitations on the following page, 320 is where he was talking about her examination findings, and then on 321, he makes a summary of what her restrictions are, and he doesn't limit the claimant in any way with regard to bending and squatting. He only limits her lifting to 20 pounds and prolonged standing to 45 minutes. And the ALJ adopted those restrictions. And really, none of the other doctors had any kind of findings that would have been consistent with problems with bending and squatting. The doctors found that she had normal ranges of motion for the most part. She had normal straight leg raising. Those are all the kinds of bending motions on examination that you would, if you had abnormal findings there, then they might have assessed limitations on bending and squatting, but none of the doctors did. So that's an important consideration, and that was reasonable for the ALJ then not to restrict the claimant in that fashion. Let's see. With regard to Dr. Desmond, he's really the only doctor that limited the claimant with regard to a mental type of restriction to tolerating stress in the workplace. But Dr. Desmond based that on the claimant's pain complaints, not on abnormal objective findings regarding her psychological functioning. And in fact, his psychological report does show a vast number of normal findings, and so that it would be very poorly supported, and the ALJ reasonably discussed that and rejected on that basis. With regard to the claimant's activities, there are statements not only in her testimony but also to her doctors about the great extent of her activities and how a number of doctors noted that she had multiple pets. She told Dr. Bedeau that she had up to 16 Lhasa Apso dogs at one time, and currently she had 5, according to her testimony. These are very long-haired dogs that she, at times, was showing in dog shows. So although she testified that she clipped the hair down, she had to do – there was a great deal of care involved in those dogs. And then she had 20 to 30 birds. Some of them were cockatiels. Some of them were parakeets. She took care of all those by herself. She also had a tropical fish tank that she said that she took care of the fish. So she had a number of pets that the doctors all said that it was fairly significant activities. And Dr. Bedeau specifically said that the activities she engaged in at home were the equivalent of light to medium work. So the doctors actually did assess that as an important activity, and Dr. Bedeau actually said it was light to medium, which is actually less restrictive than the ALJ found here. Other activities that she engaged in were things like helping her husband with the unloading of boxes and setting up store displays. And while she didn't do those things all the time, that's the type of thing that the ALJ can consider overall when he's considering credibility findings. No further questions? I'd just like to conclude that the ALJ's decision is supported by substantial evidence, and this court should affirm the district court.
You have 1 minute.
Just briefly, no dog shows in 2006, 2 in 2007. The number of dogs diminished. She mentions Dr. Desmond. Dr. Desmond was the only healthcare professional who examined her. He found a GAF of 55 to 65. Certainly that's a severe impairment, although not necessarily disabling. Definitely severe in and of itself. Dr. Bedeau, she mentions, Dr. Bedeau said this woman should see a psychiatrist. Why? Because he could see the severity of her symptoms. The thing that's in terms of her insurance, There is no evidence nothing that can be interpreted to indicate that this was not a factor that the ALJ should have considered in her not getting more psychiatric treatment. She expressed the desire for it. She said she could not afford it. Counsel basically has asked us to speculate post hoc and provide reasons for what the ALJ did. The ALJ didn't provide them in his decision, and that's something that we can only review what the ALJ said, why he did something, why he decided something. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. This case is taken.